This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Coming up, Subversity with Dan Zhang. Today is a hot day. And so stay tuned and cool down with these interviews that we're going to air, or these talk shows, or these talks that we're going to air. Today we're going to be bringing you a talk given by Professor Josephine Ho of National Central University from Taiwan. That was given last year at the Queer Asian Studies Conference in Bangkok back in July 7th or 8th or 9th. July 7th to 9th, 7th to 9th in July was this conference, the first Asian conference on sexualities, genders, and rights in Asia. She has been honored with Josephine Ho as an advocate of as a radical sex activist, and has been honored with the UNESCO Human Rights Award. And so here's her speech at last year's Asian Queer Sexualities Conference.
The cultural movement, as well as the feminist movement, following her return to Taiwan in 1988, after some time she spent in the United States, earning not one but two doctoral degrees. She later founded the Center for the Study of Sexualities, Xingye Yanjiushi, at National Central University in 1995, which is widely recognized both for its activism on the one hand and for its intellectual stamina on the other. The center's annual conferences have been continuously opening up social space for marginal issues in gender and sexuality-related theory and research by bringing to Taiwan celebrated activists and scholars from both the West and the East, including among a long list of others, such luminaries as Cindy Patton, Eve Kosofsky-Sedgwick, Neil Garcia, Han Sui-Ming, Li Yin-He, Zhang Beiquan, Leslie Feinberg, and Junko Mitsuhashi, some of whom, of course, we're also very privileged to have with us at this conference. Professor He has written both extensively and provocatively on many cutting-edge issues in the Taiwanese context, spearheading sex-positive views on female sexuality, gender and sexuality education, queer studies, sex work studies and activism, transgenderism, and most recently, in her most recent research project, which I believe is still underway, body modification. Her theoretically informed, yet always accessible books, which are all written in Chinese and are intended and are indeed very effective as timely interventions into the local Taiwanese gender and sexuality politics, include, but are not limited to, The Gallant Woman, Feminism and Sexual Emancipation, 1994, Gendered Nations, Sexuality, Capital and Culture, also 1994, Sexual Moods, A Therapeutic and Liberatory Report on Female Sexuality, 1996, Radical Sexuality Education, Gender/Sexuality Education for the New Generation, 1998, and The Admirable/Amorous Woman, also 1998. She has since written and edited no less than 8 other volumes of Taiwanese gender and sexuality research in sex work studies, queer studies, and transgender studies, which have both greatly enhanced and always provocatively challenged Taiwanese academic research into marginal genders and sexualities. As many members of today's audience will no doubt be aware, Professor He's continuous and articulate efforts on marginal issues have lately made her the number one public enemy for conservative forces in Taiwan, who have tried and indeed continue to try many different ways to silence her untiring sexual dissidence. Her academic website was forced out of academic netspace in 2001 because of its sex-positive stance on teenage sexuality. In 2003, 13 conservative NGOs banded together to bring a lawsuit against Professor He for 2 hyperlinks on what was a massive sexuality studies data bank, which led to zoophilia websites. But with the support of many people, including students, scholars, activist groups, and a widespread international petition drive, to which many people here also contributed, plus her own articulate self-defence in court, Professor He won the court case, both in the district court and later in the High Court, in 2004, so that was a great victory. And for her tireless effort in resisting bigotry and prejudice and her work on human rights and sex rights, she has recently been selected as one among the 1,000 women from all over the world who are collectively nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize earlier this year. These experiences and others have provided Professor He with a unique vantage point to analyse, in her keynote address today, the active work of conservative NGOs to rigidify social space and circumscribe queer existence in a global context. So without further ado, it's my great pleasure to give you Professor Josephine He.
Exciting day, and I hope this will not take more than an hour. Okay, the full text of my talk is included in your booklet toward the end. If you're interested, the title is Global Governance Bad for Asian Queers, and the answer will probably be very clear. It is a great pleasure and honor to address this historical conference this afternoon. The hard work of the organizers has brought together so many activists, students, scholars, and support groups from all over Asia. The sheer presence of this critical mass and the stamina of our varied work present themselves in stark contrast to, quote, the dismissal, or worse, ignorance of theoretical and ethnographic developments occurring in Asia, unquote, in relation to queer studies and queer culture. This afternoon, I'd like to focus on what I believe to be a very significant and broad-based development in Asia that not only impacts upon Asian queer existence, but also poses serious challenges to queer politics and queer theory in the region. The analysis that follows will center upon two major points. One, the emergent global hegemony of morality that has quantum leaped its assault on queer representations and interaction by bringing into place new legislations and litigations against the latter, as well as mobilizing conservative vigilance to construct an active surveillance network against any non-normative sexuality. Two, the construction of child protection as a universal imperative that in actuality works both to reinforce heterosexual monogamy and to debunk cultural diversity as inherently confusing and thus harmful for children. I have already demonstrated elsewhere how such a new global conservative morality has grafted itself onto different local sexual conservatisms and thus bringing forth new hybrid repressive measures. This hegemony of morality and its child protection war cry work together to constitute one important dimension of what has come to be known as global governance. I believe that while it may signal the weakening of state power and domination in certain national contests, global governance, envisioned as a benign network of collaboration among the various segments of the civil society, has more often than not instigated a new form of power and surveillance which has proven to be especially inimical to queers. And it is in relation to this new global development that Asian queer theory and queer activism must reconfigure its scope and engagement. In the next section, I'm going to try to explain global governance in relation to the existence of queers. In 1995, the United Nations released a report titled Our Neighborhood, Report of the Commission on Global Governance. In place of the state-oriented approaches to global politics, the report proposes a new conception and the emergent operations of the institutions practices, and processes through which global politics is organized and negotiated in the post-Cold War era. The new international order is to be conducted mainly through the multiple and flexible interaction among intergovernmental organizations, very familiar names such as the UN, the WHO, WTO, World Bank, and so forth, non-government organizations, various local or global NGOs, multinational corporations, along with state governments. It is noteworthy that in the words of UN Secretary General, NGOs are becoming, quote, partners in the process of deliberation and policy formation, as well as in the execution of policies. Sounds like a very encouraging message, but as my talk will demonstrate, queers will suffer in this raised status of NGOs. In fact, an army of NGOs has been enlisted by the UN to elevate public awareness of the need for international cooperation and to advance the report's agenda outlined as the Charter for Global Democracy. While many of the largest NGOs often have relationships and sometimes even official associative status with wide-reaching IGOs, various local NGOs in the third world also actively seek to establish relations with transnational NGOs in order to make up for the ineptness of their own governments to handle imminent social problems. The result is a complex, explicit, implicit, and evolving system of interlocking unilateral, bilateral, and multilateral body of rules and documents that are gradually assuming the role of global principles and values, while new circuits and networks of power continue to emerge. And it is these global principles and values that most concern me here. The network of NGOs that make up global governance configures quite differently within different national and social contexts. International-based NGOs have been known to set up branches in third world nations that function both as a means through which much needed funding and aid may be channeled, but also as a field where Western values and interests can exercise their influence and constitute a check and balance power against local dominion and control. The need for financial aid or commerce or affiliation may, on the other hand, leave some local NGOs in certain national contexts dependent upon transnational NGOs and thus less able of resisting the demands of global governance. In some cases, though, NGO contacts and interaction may help pass on strategies of resistance, but just as well, technologies of power from one nation to another. More significantly, though, conservative NGOs and governments are finding their way into intervening and impacting not only other states' policies, but also emergent indigenous social movements. For one thing, conservative NGOs have continuously launched boycotts of liberal-minded media programs or industrial corporations that would extend support to gay rights organizations. If you're interested in actual examples, check my footnotes. More blatantly, in 2004, U.S. government Bush added new moral strings to U.S. funding policies to exclude those NGOs, domestic or international, that support sex workers' rights or needle exchange programs or other harm reduction strategies and HIV/AIDS prevention advocacy. The moral decree is already producing a serious impact on third world NGOs and their work. In these cases and many others, the intermingling of NGOs of different calibers with state governments of different democratic formations further complicate regional differences, resulting in a very complex web of relations, exchanges, and tug of wars. Advocates of global governance may celebrate the gradual weakening of state power and the enhanced role of NGOs as a desirable progressive development inducive to the expansion of global democracy. Yet, it needs to be pointed out that the structural complexity of this expanding so-called global civil society and its consensus-building negotiations have tended to favor certain visions and certain values that may be quite inhospitable to queer existence. To begin with, the UN support calls for the establishment of a, quote, global civic ethic, unquote, based on, quote, a set of core values that can unite people of all cultural, political, religious, and philosophical backgrounds, unquote. As appealing as this imaginary brotherhood, sisterhood may sound, such core values have had partial success mostly on broad topics such as universal human rights or global environmental concerns. But even there, disputes and cultural differences run high. The problems of universalism aside, this envisioned so-called global and civic ethic, with its inherent assumptions about cultural commonality and nationalistic civility, cannot help but find its baseline of agreement only in those areas most deeply entrenched in a benign but unreflexive humanism, areas where long-standing differences are glossed over and long-held prejudice and fears remain buried and unchallenged. And what better topic and grounds for enforcing international civility than the field of sexuality? Furthermore, consensus building in politics and economic stability, which is what global governance is all about, often relies upon a strong power of regulation. And this power of regulation is not without its preferred targets. Speaking of the world under global governance, Remo Väyrynen points out, in the multi-centric world, the world of global governance, power not only is dispersed, but it also assumes more forms than the traditional power analysis suggests. For instance, power can also be symbolic and reputational, as well as material, and it may reflect conventions and narratives. The fluidity of soft power means that it is difficult to capture and use for specific purposes. One implication of this state of affairs is that in the multi-centric world, traditional power resources alone cannot assume stability and progress. The management of power must be based also on norms and institutions. End of quote. Norms and institutions refer to structural constraints embodied in various international conventions and agencies, and more significantly, in local legislations that tend to favor normative lifestyles. Symbolic and reputational, on the other hand, signals a form of power that is extremely sensitive toward possible scandalous elements, elements that find their most potent expression in things sexual. Such norms thus tend to be the norms of respectability that Iris Marion Young has described, and this is a quote from her, norms that repress sexuality, bodily functions, and emotional expression. The respectable person is thus chaste, modest, does not express lustful desires, passion, spontaneity, or exuberance, is frugal, clean, gently spoken, and well-mannered. The orderliness of respectability means things are under control, everything in its place, not crossing the borders. Somehow that sounds like everything opposite of this conference. NGOs are not inherently conservative or progressive, pro-state or non-state oriented, pro-queer or anti-queer. Yet, while the ideological formation of each NGO's social historical emergence does significantly inform its basic nature and direction, we are now also witnessing the operation of a powerful force of co-optation that makes up global governance. That is, NGOs are constantly tempted or invited to join state or global rule, so as to share resources and legitimacy. Worse, the global civic ethic that makes up the world of multi-centered global governance cannot but uphold and demand NGO civic respectability at the expense of difficult topics in relation to sexuality. Thus, it will tend to avoid challenging sexual stigma. It will hesitate about recognizing multiple sexualities. It will have strong reservations about freedom of sex-related information and interaction on the internet. And as compliance with these standards of civic respectability has become a token of state legitimacy, of political correctness in international relations, this new deployment of normative power also tends to favor a global social milieu in which non-normative sexualities are always deemed possible threats. In the next section, I'm going to get into the legislation parts to follow up on the first keynote speaker. Significantly, this emergent reign of respectability is now finding its most potent presence in the legal domain as global governance spreads across nations. In other words, sexual acts, sexual identities, sexual information, sexual exchange, and so forth, are increasingly subjected to the regulation of codified laws. The UN Commission on Global Governance had decreed that governance be underpinned by democracy on all levels and ultimately, quote, by the rule of enforceable law, unquote. Nations are thus encouraged to bring their laws into alignment with UN decrees, and conservative NGOs in various countries have been working feverishly, rallying legislators to amend old laws and institute new laws, oftentimes in accordance with conservative agendas. This significant redeployment of power, which Jürgen Habermas has aptly described as, quote, juridification, unquote, in our late modern age, asserts itself by having more and more formal laws created in the social cultural sphere, the private sphere, and the body-related sphere, the density of which leaves little social space outside the reach and definition of the law. We are witnessing laws collapsing so-called revered borders of the private sphere. In fact, legislations that aggressively regulate sexual conduct, sexual contact, and sexual information have already come into place all over Asia, including regulations over sexual harassment, sexual assault, surrogate mothering, artificial insemination, HIV status, new sex-related drugs such as RU486 and Viagra, and most importantly, sexual information and interaction on the internet, and so forth. Furthermore, the legal machines of the states may be somewhat cumbersome or inefficient to live up to the spirit of juridification, yet conservative NGOs are quick to lend a helping hand by, for example, organizing web monitoring volunteers to fill in the gap and activate the legal machine. Recently, NGO-sponsored conservative legislations and monitoring activities regarding surveillance of sex-related activities and information on the internet in many countries have made it quite difficult for queers to conduct their most common practices of flirtation and sexual negotiation. One very important example in Taiwan is you can no longer brag about the size of your penis on the internet without the law coming after you saying that it's bad influence on children who may be surfing the internet. It is now obvious that the new legislations have greatly exacerbated already existing social sexual stigma against marginal sexualities, not to mention bringing actual litigations against many of these individuals. Increasingly, social differences are no longer dealt with through communicative reason. Instead, the force of the law is directly applied. Disciplinary management has now replaced communication. Asian queers, like queers everywhere, had hoped that new anti-discrimination legislation would mitigate the social ills of homophobia and sexphobia, yet in more than one country in Asia, such proposed legislation is facing serious backlash, if not total frustration. Ironically, the obstacle has a lot to do with two other NGO conglomerates. To begin with, women's NGOs that make up the major force in pushing for a general anti-discrimination legislation are now somewhat hesitant about incorporating LGBTQ causes for fear of hindering their own hard-fought equal rights claims. United Nations-sponsored gender mainstreaming may have propagated the gender analytic with its implicit biological framework, but that analytic has often elided discussions about sexual orientation and gender variance. This reluctance becomes even more obvious when gender mainstreaming faces its own difficulties in various national contexts. After all, gender mainstreaming aims to mainstream gender, not gender marginalities or gender variance, much less sexual marginalities and diversity. Simply put, most women's NGOs are not ready to tackle the force of sexual stigma, and some of them even capitalize on such sexual stigma to erect more protective surveillance correction institutions, as well as sexphobic legal codes, all in the name of women protection, or, ominously, child protection.
You're listening to a talk given by Professor Josephine Ho from Taiwan about the state and NGOs that formalize and institutionalize restrictive sexual codes based on outdated visions of society. This is Dan Zhang with Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI.
Secondly, the other NGO conglomerate. Queer causes face real formidable foes in the Christian-based conservative NGOs. Spurred on by a sense of imminent crisis in their decreasing social relevance, but feeling liberated, ironically, by the discourse of pluralism and multiculturalism to propagate their discriminatory discourses and their vendetta against anything non-normative, conservative religious, especially Christian groups, have recently become dramatically more outspoken about their opposition to gay rights. With their long-standing missionary global network, this religion-based opposition has taken advantage of the social space opened up by multiculturalism and are now aggressively characterizing queer existence as an alarming global trend that will be damaging for the young and fragile. The queer scare, I have named it, has not only displaced social anxiety and fear toward globalization onto local queers and the latter's proposed anti-discrimination legislation, but also encouraged actual litigation against previously acceptable local queer practices. The prosecution and recent conviction of Taiwan's only gay Jingjing bookstore for, quote, dissemination of obscene materials, unquote, served as a sobering reminder that the law is now being employed to make a statement on queer cultural images. It is most unfortunate that both mainstreaming women's NGOs and conservative religious Christian NGOs have chosen to abide by the most basic form of sexual fundamentalism. The notion that there is a singular, ideal sexuality, which is heterosexual, marital, procreative, and two genders, men and woman, none other, and that those conforming to this standard have a right to police and control others, often by creating and enforcing new legislations. When such sexual fundamentalism pervades major conservative NGOs, women's NGOs, and the tabloidized media in Asia, emergent sexual practices, sexual values, and sexual activism easily become occasions for moral panics. The media consistently magnify the daily lives of already out or suspected marginal sexual subjects, probing and exposing intimacies, demonizing alternative lifestyles, confirming stereotypes and prejudices, and sometimes even fabricating sex scares. While gay activism rarely receives media coverage, gay saunas, lesbian bars, busted gay home parties, and the like regularly come under the scrutinizing lenses of the media and always narrated from the point of view of the most conservative or normative. In reality, it is the manufactured distance between the sexual fundamentalist narration and the vibrant and lively presentations of new sexual practices that constitute the effect of sensationalism. Sensationalism is, after all, the emotional dramatization of the most rigid and conservative moral position. As sexual hysterias have now become a mainstay in the media, they are unfailingly and flexibly used by the conservative NGOs and the state to encourage social vigilance against the non-formative. Here we see the work of not only the state, not only the NGOs, the people's organizations, but also regular citizens being encouraged to be vigilant about the sexually non-normative. Such sexual codification have met with limited resistance in Asian countries where the forces of modernization have begun to take root. As social mobility and keen competition in the newly prospering Asian states inserting unpredictable variables into the reproduction of class, there is plenty of middle class anxiety to be galvanized and reshaped into a fear for the safety of their children, projected as all children, and an aggressive impulse to keep them safe, safe from anything characterized as harmful or distracting to their so-called normal development into designated class, gender, sex positions. Middle-class parents thus make up the staunchest supporters of conservative NGOs in the latter's crusade to purify the world. And as Asian nations race toward liberal democracy on this wave of middle-class self-affirmation, the NGO's noble cause and righteous image greatly contribute to the codification and juridification that helps to make up state power and state legitimacy. And this middle-class conception of children, child protection, will be the focus of the next section, the child protection imperative. The immense power of the cultural imaginary of the child can be partially glimpsed in the success of the ratification of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. It is the first legally binding international instrument to incorporate the full range of human rights, civil and political rights, as well as economic, social, and cultural rights. The Convention on the Rights of the Child is also the most universally accepted human rights document in history, believe it or not, ratified by every country in the world except two. Total number 192. Talk about universal consensus. By ratifying this document, national governments commit themselves to protecting and ensuring children's rights, and they agree to hold themselves accountable for this commitment before the international community. As the Convention protects children's rights by setting standards in healthcare, education, and legal, civil, and social services, many Asian countries are working aggressively to identify national laws and practices that need to be brought in line with the UN's definition. And it is these efforts that often provide occasions for conservative maneuvers. For while the Convention helped highlight the need to protect children from abuse, violence, deprivation, and economic exploitation, the most active and fruitful among the NGO efforts have been those that aim at the protection of children from sexual abuse and exploitation. By sexual abuse and exploitation, the conservative NGOs mean anything and everything sexual that comes within the reach of anyone below the age of 18, the UN-designated age definition for children. Now, for some child protection agencies, their advocated age for children is 24. In Taiwan, as a matter of fact, it is being advocated in Taiwan, and youths from Taiwan are organizing, and the new organization is going to be called U24, under 24, in response to this trend. In Taiwan, to give a concrete example, all social space and cyberspace alike are now strictly patrolled by not only the police, but more pervasively by hotline volunteers from local child protection NGOs. Working in accordance with the code of practice published by global NGOs such as INHO, the Association of Internet Hotline Providers, local NGOs aim to upgrade their power of influence by serving as active agents for international organizations, plus agents for the state government. Narratives of demonized cases are fed to the media regularly. Statistics are accumulated and presented to the local government to demand more regulation of the internet. The newly revamped, in Taiwan, Children's Welfare Act proves to be irresistible, even as it impinges upon basic civil rights in Taiwan. Legislations to such child protection for purposes have already created serious restrictions over even adult-oriented sexual information and interaction on the internet. For, according to the child protection NGOs, children may inadvertently bump into such information or activity while surfing the internet innocently and may become adversely affected. Significantly, in the hands of conservative NGOs, such protective measures are always, almost always, proactively applied, which means nothing has happened yet, but let's prevent something from happening. So preemptive measures are taken place. As gays and lesbians are often imagined as sexually ferocious and constantly preying on the innocent, the effect of the sex offender notification system that is now being considered for legislation in countries including Australia, Japan, and Taiwan could prove to be far-reaching, because you don't have to have really done something, but you could be kept, your name could be kept on the list. Despite its seeming goodwill, the child protection discourse is often used by conservative NGOs to generate other meanings that can easily be turned against queers. Most often encouraged is the attending characterization of the child as vulnerable and constantly in need of protection, thus formulating an emotional nexus around the idea of the child that staves off anything queer. For underneath the emotional investment in the child is a deeply rooted fixation on a heterosexual monogamous family, which alone can guarantee the child's birth, upbringing, cultivation, gender socialization, and emotional maturity. The child, understood as the future of mankind or the family lineage, carries a preemptive biblical and cultural authority that decrees heterosexuality as elemental to the survival of species, a noble obligation from which queers have been shown to deliberately elide. The common complaint that, and this is from one Taiwanese legislator, gayness will cause the family and the nation to perish, also aptly expresses the deep-rooted anxiety of reproduction-oriented Asian cultures. Here, Christian doctrines and Asian traditions, often at odds with one another, happily converge on the issues of the family and child protection. The result is none other than a rejuvenation and legitimation of parenting power, a power that had been greatly diminishing and challenged in the sweeping influence of modern individualism, but has now found a new cause and fervor. The child, understood as supreme innocence, must then be kept safe from harmful influences, influences that could distract it from the heteronormative track of, quote from the UN document, developing to the fullest. Influences that are better known as anything queer. To ensure the intactness of that innocence, new forms of discipline regulation are created that ends up affecting all adults, queer or straight. All things sexual must be kept out of sight. All sexual knowledge and representation must be considered taboo. All non-normative sexualities are presented as pathological. All interactions must be desexualized. Conservative Christian NGOs are also very good at invoking high-voltage imageries associated with sexuality and the human body to dramatize the harm queer lifestyles and queer culture could bring upon the child, thus further aggravating the anxiety and the fear of parent-assuming adults. In collaboration with the protectionist mode of thinking, child protection discourses quickly come to be aligned with like-minded anti-sex women protection discourses. And without a critical radical perspective, it is only a matter of time that they become fetus protection discourses, as is already the case in the West, thus continuously broadening the circle of protection and strengthening the conservative NGO's power of influence, which in the final analysis contributes significantly to the grand project of state legitimacy as well as global governance. In my conclusion part, I'd like to ask whether this is the time to consider the end of people. Perhaps most of us share the feeling that social space is shrinking and queers are faced with formidable obstacles on the road to liberation. As I have tried to demonstrate in my talk this afternoon, in many parts of Asia, various local or grassroots citizen groups, riding on the help of various supra-state international organizations or international NGOs, have become franchises of state bureaucracy and power. They have become actually state-approved organizations, intensely interested in becoming part of the government in its double meaning of sharing the power and resources of the state, as well as ruling over the populations. Such a new state NGO power block is embodied sometimes in the mutual interpenetration of people and power and money, and other times through a network of exchanges in symbolic values such as mutual endorsement or mutual legitimation. The result then is a new power formation that has been termed the flat governance of new populism, where power is horizontally spread among non-government organizations and citizen groups who now act as franchises for the state in maintaining vigilance over governance. The state NGO regime has been gaining strength in relation to newly constructed subjects for rule and in relation to the new spheres where regulation, surveillance of marginal populations and their activities carry insurmountable weight, where bodies and everyday life serve as prime targets. The collaboration between the state and conservative NGOs in civil society has made progressive activism all the more difficult, as active consent is continuously manufactured in the name of child protection, and new forms of regulation surveillance assume the form and power of legally enforceable laws. This protection-minded sexual authoritarianism, coupled with the shifting of alliance and developing global governance, is what Asian queers will have to contend with. In that sense, queer politics will have to broaden its scope and engage issues beyond the realm of sexual rights and equality, beyond sexual identities and community. Queer politics will have to be coalition politics too, building up counter-alliances with other activist groups in resistance to co-optation by the state, learning to see the global situation from marginal angles and concerns, and perhaps through this kind of marginal coalition, working together to implode global governance from within. On the theoretical front, queer theory will have to build up discourses that can articulate sexuality with traditional political economy, as well as global governance theory, so as to better tackle the new global deployment of power that faces us. Queer theory will have to intervene in political philosophy, critical theory, cultural studies, so as to undo the nexus of cultural imaginary that links up the child, the woman, the family, the NGOs, the nation, the world, and so forth. So, is global governance bad for Asian queers? Well, my paper seems to have focused more on the doomsday version of analysis in which conservative groups are shown to be forging an ever more thorough network of surveillance and penalty by mobilizing adult, especially parental, anxieties toward a rapidly changing world and by instituting new legislations and litigations against queer representations and queer practice. All this is true enough. Yet it is also a fact that queer NGOs, despite the silencing effect of sexual social stigma, are also building global alliances through modern communication technology, as well as through precious international conventions such as the present one, so as to seek support and information that may help in their own local struggles. As we gather for these days of exchange and mutual learning, I hope we take the opportunity to build another kind of coalition politics. If the last century is the century when the people rose against the oppressive rule of states, then in the age of global governance, faced with a new power block made up of states in collaboration with conservative NGOs, we must learn to entertain a renewed understanding of, quote, the people, unquote. A simplified understanding of a unified people power is no longer valid in our day and age. Instead, the real power of resistance lies with queer power, the power that contests any firm grasp of identity formation, the power that constitutes new and unexpected modes of intimate alliance, the power that is quick in forging and consolidating new coalitions, and the power that resists the temptations of the new state NGO power block. Global governance may not have been all that good for Asian queers, but our gathering here promises another kind of global alliance that can certainly intervene and make a huge difference. Thank you.
You've been listening to a talk given by Professor Josephine Ho from National Central University in Taiwan at the Asian Sexualities Conference last July in Bangkok, Thailand. Feminist scholar Josephine Ho was the keynote speaker at that conference. She has written extensively and provocatively over the past decade to open up a new discursive space for gender and sexuality issues in Taiwan. Her theoretically informed yet popularly accessible books, all written in Chinese, have been timely as timely interventions into the politics of gender and sexuality in Taiwan include The Gallant Woman, Feminism and Sexual Emancipation, Gendered Nations, Sexuality, Capital and Culture, Sexual Moods, a Therapeutic and Liberatory Report on Female Sexuality, Female Sexual Education, Gender Sexuality Education for a New Generation, and The Admiral Amorous Woman. She has since written and edited 8 volumes of Taiwanese gender sexuality research and sex work studies, queer studies, and transgender studies, which have greatly enhanced local academic research into marginalized genders and sexualities. Her present research interests lie with the extreme bodies and sexuality, with extreme bodies and sexuality. She's head of the Center for the Study of Sexualities at National Central University in Taiwan. established in 1995 and is well known for both its activism and its intellectual stamina. The center is noted for its international conferences that have featured scholars including Cindy Patton, Eve Sedgwick, D.A. Miller, Neil Garcia, Judith Halberstam, Leslie Feinberg, Anne Boleyn, and Jamison Green. Her work has been instrumental in nurturing the emergence of a new generation of young local scholars in sexuality studies. And so that was Josephine Ho from Taiwan, her lecture. You can go to the Subversity website at kuci.org/tildedtsang for further information later today. We'll add links to her talk. This is Dan Zhang with Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.